the time of the judges, but there's a period of time when Eglon, the king of Moab, right, took over the nation of Israel. Not that he owned the nation of Israel, he put them under tribute. And do you guys remember the whole thing? And then someone came in and stabbed Eglon in his big stomach and all that. All crazy stuff ensues. But the king of Moab, so they are the enemies of Israel. That's where they fled for the sake of a brighter future. For the sake of, right, of family preservation. For the sake of security. We could translate that to, hey, there was better jobs there. Right? There's better opportunities. And so we took whatever opportunities were presented to us for the sake of having a good future. A good future is the opposite of what actually would take place there. Look at verse 3. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. So pause right there, right? The first tragedy to hit Naomi's life is that her husband Elimelech, who had moved their family from Bethlehem, right, to Moab, he dies. So he's left his wife widowed, without a husband, in a foreign land. And again, what's bad about a foreign land? It's not that God hates all lands except for the land of Israel. The idea is the culture, and in particular, the religion. Where culture, religion, and people groups are all considered one and the same in the Old Testament, and they looked at it that way, and they understood it that way. Like, here she was, traveling amongst the pagans, living amongst them, trying to figure out how to get by in life when now her husband has passed away. Was it a judgment of God? Maybe. The beauty of the book of Ruth is that it is so literarily refined and so well presented that it doesn't tell us the heart of any individual. It only tells us what they did and what they said. It doesn't give judgment on certain individuals for the things that had happened. Could it have been that it was sin for them to leave Bethlehem, and as a result of that, that this is some of the things that happened? Possibly, but we don't know. We'll leave it at that. Verse 4. So Naomi is left without a husband and with two sons. Verse 4, these took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah. That's Orpah, not, I know you're thinking, right? You're thinking Oprah, right? Right? You get a car, you get a car. No. This is I almost said it wrong too. It's Orpah. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. Probably Orpah married the oldest, and Ruth married the youngest, because they're given in that order. They lived there about 10 years, and listen on, read on. And both Mahlon, the oldest, Chilion, the youngest, they both died. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Now let me back up for a second. Mahlon, right, and Chilion married Moabite women. That is forbidden in the Old Testament to the nation of Israel. And again, it's not because God hates Moabites, mosquito bites, right? All the other ites. It's not because God hates other people or groups. It is because the natural relationship of incorporating yourself into that family, into that people, into that group, is that you will begin to take on their cultures, because their culture is always invested into their pagan religions. Well, why aren't you offering the little, you know, incense offering to your ancestral gods? Why don't you show up at the anniversary death of your grandmother and bow down in front of her gravestone? You see some of those even in Asian cultures today. I mean, that is the natural reality. And so, places like Deuteronomy 7 say, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons. For they would, and catch this, because it's not just racism. It's not an Old Testament version of racism, though maybe some made it look like that. It's, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. Could it be that Mahlon and Chilion in their marriage of Moabite women, that is a judgment of God, and that's why they died? Possibly. Is that exactly what the Holy Spirit gives us in the pages of Ruth? No. So again, we'll consider that's a possibility, but we'll leave that alone for now. This is the part that I think is interesting. After 10 years, they said, Mahlon and Chilion died childless. All right? They took Moabite wives, In the second part of verse 4, they lived there about 10 years. After taking wives, 10 years is a long time to not have children, especially in a culture where you don't plan for your parenthood. You immediately have kids, right? Everyone does. And the blessing of having children, and many of them, is kind of the main ambition of the family unit. You increase family, you increase tribe. You increase tribe, you increase nation. 10 years, they were childless. And then both of these young men die. The most curious thing in that entire opening sequence of giving us the tragic sojourning, the background of our story, is if you notice the second part of verse 5, the last phrase there. So that the woman, that's singular, was left without her two sons and her husband. You notice it doesn't say, and so that the women, right, are bereft of all of their husbands. It focuses particularly on Naomi's difficulty. The driving force of this particular passage is that Naomi is broken. Everything that she had hoped for, a more secure place for her family, a future for her children, and hopefully her grandchildren. Not wicked desires, things that we might all share in. They're dashed. They're gone. She is a widow, and a widow indeed. Meaning that she doesn't have a husband, yeah, but she doesn't have surrounding family to help her. She had two sons, and perhaps part of saying, okay, go and marry a Moabite woman because that's all we got, and we need to have some children because my life and our future and the family name is about to die. Talk more about the whole idea of the family name. But with all of that dying off, we have a responsibility here. So let's have kids. Let's continue on. And all of that is lost. She's a widow. She's childless. There's almost no chance of grandchildren. And after 10 years, she's not going to remarry, nor is her daughter-in-law's. I mean, maybe they have a potential of remarrying, but there's no near kinsmen for them to remarry so that they might continue on the line of Elimelech, right? How do you help someone like that? How do you counsel someone like that? I mean, we have to walk in her shoes for a moment. We need to understand the depth of her pain. We need to sit with her a little bit, right? We don't just show up and go, you know what? You need to trust the Lord more. Crying over dead husbands and dead sons. What's your problem? Now, we need to have more compassion than that. We should see that their struggle is a real struggle. Their struggle for faith is understandable. That they are in the most dire of circumstances, and everything that they have hoped for has been dashed to pieces. Everything that she might have found security in this life, right? A sense of you know, home, being stable, having enough income so they might eat, right? Taking care of her generation and the generation after that. Identity, having a husband, having a name, having a clan, having children, having their children have children. Getting hugs from little ones. I mean, these delightful, wonderful things that are part of the entire identity of who she might be and our hope. Future is dead. This desire to be part of the nation of Israel and continue on that legacy of the tribe of Judah under Elimelech, all gone. The temptation that she is overwhelmed with is the temptation to just fold up and die, to despair, to become bitter, to become angry with God. And if we were trying to biblically one another her, if we're trying to care for her, how do you help her? I mean, you don't just go, oh yeah, you know, I guess God wasn't strong enough. Just wasn't strong enough to kind of protect you. You know, that's how crazy this world is. That doesn't help us. And it's not true. The only thing we're trying to do is say, whatever it is that we felt, that she felt so needing of in this life, her circumstances, identity, hope, security, joy, she has to find that in the Lord. That is her only chance of making it, right? Because everything else will not be sufficient. This is the tragic sojourning from Bethlehem to Moab of a particular lady named Naomi. And isn't that interesting that the author, the way that he writes it, I don't know if it's Samuel, I don't know if it's one of the other prophets, but the way that he writes it paints a picture of it is her pain first and foremost. And then it's how she interacts with that pain with even her daughter-in-laws. our story continues on, but having that as the backdrop, here then is the main part of chapter 1. It's the interaction between Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws. What should Naomi do with them? They're young enough that maybe there's still a hope for them, a hope in this life. So how should she encourage them? What should she counsel them? The setting for Naomi, for Naomi's pleads for a safer life. Naomi is going to plead with them for a safer life in verses 6 through 15. But in verses 6 and 7, gives us a little bit, a single ray of hope that maybe some things in the world are getting better. Verse 6 says, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had learned, or she had heard in the fields of Moab, that the Lord had visited his people and given them food." Notice there, she calls upon the name of the Lord, and you notice the small caps in your study Bibles, right? L-O-R-D, all capitals. And that refers not to Adonai, the Hebrew word for Lord, but it refers to Yahweh, the personal name of the covenant God of Israel's people. This is her calling on the personal name of God. She's saying Yahweh had visited his people, and so the famine has been reversed, and he's given them food. So, verse 7, she sets out. And she is decisive, if nothing else. She got up because she heard this news in the early part of verse 6. Verse 7, so she sets out, and later on, to return, right? So arose, to return, to set out, right? So verse 7, she sets out from the place where she is with. She was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. They were already en route, probably have left. They're on this dirt road, I imagine, on this highway, as they are walking themselves in the midst of their poverty and tragedies. They are walking away from Moab back towards Bethlehem, her hometown. Verse 8. The question was, what does Naomi do with these daughters-in-law? But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. Naomi's plea for a safer life for her daughters-in-law is, one, is a return home and be blessed. Go home, return home, and be blessed. That's verses 6 through 10, all right? And notice that she says it with it as a command, go home, but she says it tenderly, with affection, and with a great deal of a blessing. She wants them to be blessed in this life, in this earthly, material, insecure life. She is motivated by love. Look at what she says. She says, go return each one of you to your mother's house. In other words, go back to the home you grew up in. Get back to that safety and security. Yes, you know, we had important things. We had good times, and we have loved each other, but it's now time for you to return. And then she says, and here's the blessing I cast upon you. A blessing would be like a prayer. This is what she wishes on these two young women. Older women now, or middle-aged women, let's be fair, right? May the Lord deal kindly with you. Right? May the Lord deal kindly with you. The term that's behind the may he grant you kindness, or deal kindly with you, is the term chesed from the Old Testament Hebrew. And I the only reason why I give it to you is because it's a term that we should be somewhat familiar with by now, right? We find that throughout the pages of the Old Testament scriptures, and it's the closest thing that links us to the New Testament concept of charis, of grace. But chesed is so much deeper. It's not just graciousness. It's sometimes translated kindness. Sometimes it's translated love. Sometimes it's translated faithfulness. It encompasses the entire range of the beneficial nature of someone like God who promises something good and delivers on that goodness from the heart. Chesed, she says, may the Lord grant to you chesed, right? Because you have granted me chesed. In other words, she is commending her daughters-in-law for having given her grace, kindness, having loved her. Even after husbands have died, they have hung on to care for her. I don't know how old Naomi is, but she must be old enough, or at least maybe she's been impoverished enough that she is feeble, because once they get back to Bethlehem, one of the things that you notice is that she's not out there gleaning. You don't have to be, right? You don't have to be crazy strong to pick up some wheat.
even a little bit. But she seems to send only Ruth because she's either too despondent or more likely, physically, she is wearing down. And these daughters-in-laws have been good to her. And so she's saying, may God bless you with the kind of kindness that you have granted to me. And then verse 9, and may Yahweh, she calls on his name again, may he grant to you to find rest. What a blessed thing for her to wish upon them. The term means to find security or settledness. It's the opposite of restlessness and wandering. She's praying that the Lord would grant to them a home, family, life, all those things that we think are so important and precious to us in this world. And notice how she says it, right, in verse 9. She says, may the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Not the husband that has died, right? She's saying, go find a new husband and make a home and a family and kind of find that American / Moabite dream, you know? Go find that fulfillment that you see in your commercials. You know what I mean? Like, go and do that. Naomi desires desperately, as we parents would desire desperately for her, the only kids that she has in her fold. They are daughters-in-law, but nevertheless, she loves them. You're going to see the extent of her love for them, even in the way that she talks to them. But as she loves them, as her own children, she wants what is good in this life. If you have to choose, you'd want a stable, secure future for your kids. You know? And if the Lord put it to you and said, listen, there's salvation or stable, secure financial future. I mean, I think as good parents, we'd naturally go, well, yeah, I mean, Lord, we can have a little bit of both. You know? Like, if it's either or, then of course, give them salvation. But if we, you know, if it's a little mingling of both, you know, I wouldn't mind a little bit of stability. I wouldn't mind not worrying about and being anxious about how they're going to take care of theirs. I would love it, Lord, if you got them into a great college and gave them an excellent job and gave them friends that have kind of a similar background. I'd love it for them to find that stability and joy and security in this life. And that's her. That's her. Naomi is asking a blessing upon them because she assumes this is the end of the line. And then it says, and then she kissed them as an act of affection. It meant to be the final send-off. It's a kiss of separation. And then, I love it, they lifted up their voices and wept. See, the added dimension of they lifted up their voices tells us that it wasn't just tears are flowing and they're hugging it out. It means they were wailing. They were yelling. They were crying out because it was painful for all of them. Right? The idea of separating is painful, but it's also the idea of everything that has happened up to this point. They lost Elimelech already. They lost their husbands already. 10 years they've been trying, no kids. And now the husbands are gone. Things have not gone too well for any of these ladies. And they share in that. They love each other in that moment. And they're committed to each other in affection. Naomi has every intention to say, go home and be blessed and to be filled. And even though I will not see you, you know, for the rest of my days on earth, then at least I might have the joy and peace of knowing that maybe you guys are doing well, that you have a home with a husband, a family, and that you're secure. But, verse 10, they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. It gives you a sense of why or what their relationship was like. These guys weren't just hanging around because they had nothing else to do. They're not just trying to figure out how they could get the most out of Naomi. They were committed to her sacrificially. We're going to go with you. We're going to take care of you. And we're going to go back to your people. I would argue with you that the Moabites knew exactly what they were going to face if they go to the country of Israel, in the same way that the Israelites knew what they were going to face if they go to the country of Moab. All right? This isn't just, you just, you know, let me hop on a plane and go visit England, you know? Go visit, you know, the people on the other side of the pond, right? This isn't just about cultural difference. This is, again, this is about God versus gods. This is about cultures that offend versus cultures that offend. About wars that have happened again and again, repeatedly, right? Skirmishes, angers, etc. They would face persecution. There's no question. And everyone would recognize, aren't those guys Moabites? What are they doing here? Nevertheless, they are committed to her and to her people. Naomi's first plea for a safe life is return home. Go home and be blessed. They say, no, we're going to walk with you. So her second plea in verse 11 through 13 is turn back and be safe. See, this is more desperate now. Naomi is absolutely convinced that they have no future. So she continues on to plead even deeper. There, she is given a blessing in the first plea, but this one is just a warning. Naomi said to them, verse 11, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband in this night, should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Turn back. This is a warning at this point. Let's be real, she says. Let's be rational. I know we're emotional right now, but let's think about this. What are your options? One, you go with me to Bethlehem. You go to care for a dying and childless widow who no longer has a name because we have no sons between us. So there's not even a plot of land that belongs to us that will return to us every 70th year in the year of jubilation, right? There's nothing like that. We don't have a heritage. We're just going back to a town that's familiar to me. Probably begging for food. As far as Naomi's concerned, and maybe she's being short-sighted, I don't know, but she doesn't even have family, relatives to look to. Go back. Don't go to Bethlehem with me to care for a dying and childless widow. Embracing the pain of potentially living out your days just like me. There's no hope here. Or the more rational option, according to Naomi's argument, why don't you turn back to Moab? Take a chance on getting married, having a family, living that dream. You're young enough, you got a chance. I don't. This is Naomi revealing her inner pain. She's literally saying, I have nothing to offer you. I have no hope, and why would I force you to bind yourself to this hopeless life? You would follow me into a life of barrenness, emptiness, and death? No emotional attachments are worth the struggles of life that faces Naomi. That would be her argument. So she says, turn back. And notice the terms of affection. Turn back, my daughters, verse 11. Turn back, my daughters, verse 12. Second part of verse 13, no, my daughters, it is exceedingly bitter for me for your sake. Meaning that it is more bitter when I think about you coming along for this terrible ride. It just gets worse and worse. And on top of everything else, I could not bear to watch you fall apart and fade before my very eyes. I would rather you go back. Turn back. Find hope. Verse 12 and 13, she mentions something that I think is kind of forebodes of what the Lord is doing providentially. And Naomi probably has no clue whatsoever as she says it. She says, turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. Right? If I should say, I have hope, right? Which she doesn't. Even if I should have a husband this night and bear sons. In other words, even if I got married right now and then I got pregnant right now and then I even had a son 9 months, right? Like this was the end of the 9 months and tonight I had a child. Are you going to wait for that child? You going to wait another 20 years? You waited 10 years, right? You guys couldn't have kids and now you're going to wait another 20 years to hopefully, potentially have a baby with my future children? Would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? And she is speaking of this concept of levirate marriage. Don't worry about the name. The concept comes from Deuteronomy 25. And the idea is this. If a woman's husband dies before she bears him children, then either the husband's brother or near relative must marry her. And then at least the firstborn would take the name of that dead husband. In other words, see, this is the thing that maybe we're not catching, right? The concept of Levirate marriage was for the nation of Israel because they were a nation, and all of them in their tribes and in their subdivisions under their tribes, they're all given a portion of the promised land. That's not just a piece of land, that is a generational promise. It connects them to the generations of the past that look forward to a time when God will rule the world from this particular location. And it looks forward, right, in terms of my stewardship, to hand it down to future generations. That's why, as a part of the culture of the Old Testament, you find that the idea of being barren was so weighty. Because part of the promise to Abraham was not just that he'll be a blessing to the world, but that he'll be a blessing to a nation, and that they would own a land, and through that nation and that land and that king, the entire world would be saved. It's kind of like saying, you, by virtue of who you are ancestrally born into, because of the ancestral line, you own a piece of what is going to become heaven on earth. Literally. It's not just about a name. I think in our day and age, it's almost funny to me that we care so much about carrying on a name or a legacy. Right? And I think I've seen that fade, even from you guys. I don't think it's as big of a deal. I have to have a son to carry out my name. Man, there's like 5 billion Parks in the world. You know, that's my last name. And you know, as far as all the Korean other Parks that I've met, they all claim that they come from the line of Parks that are from royalty. That can't possibly be true, right? Not all of them, right? And so George and I, we just kind of always joke around and say, we're probably from the peasant side, right? Because really, who cares? Like, can I actually go back to Korea and claim, like, listen, I'm of the Park Dynasty Parks. Where my piece of land, fool? Right? Can you do that? Is there something waiting for me there? Is there some legacy that actually pays something for? Of course not. And so, if I love my sons, if I never had sons and the park name didn't carry on, that wouldn't be a big deal to me. All right? Some of our parents here are blessed with just daughters. I don't see that as any less of a blessing than having sons. Who cares? It's just your name. But see, my point is, in the nation of Israel, and at that time, it's not just a name. It's how you're connected with the promised land and the promised people and the promise of a king to come to rescue us and to rescue the world. And Naomi's point is, we've lost it all. We literally have lost it all. In almost like a reverse lotto, instead of hitting it rich, we have literally become destitute. We don't have a name. I'm the wife of Elimelech, but he has no sons. And whatever once belonged to him will pass to some kinsman, to some second or third cousin. There is no future. We have literally lost everything that could have been ours. Everything that is a hope for future generations. She says, no, my daughters. This is exceedingly bitter. It hurts even more for me to think that for my sake, that to me, for your sake, that you would go with me when the hand of the Lord, when the hand of Yahweh has gone out against me. You notice her interpretation of her circumstances is not absolutely incorrect. She's fairly right about her theology. When she said that the hand of Yahweh has gone out against me, it's true. It's not because her theology is absolutely wrong, it's just incomplete. Is God in his providential hand, was he there when Elimelech died? Yes. When Mahlon and Chilion passed away, yes. When they were childless, and then all three of them are huddled together in their pain and in their sorrow, is God a part of that? The answer is yes. But here's the key. Providence means that maybe that's not all God is doing. Standing by and watching you hurt. How do we help those that are suffering? By pretending that God's not really responsible, oh, he would never do such a thing. Our loving God, he would never let bad things happen. That just means God's not strong enough. And that means that we are at the whim of every dangerous possibility that could ever hit us. Scriptures tell us that God is the God that does all things. He gives life and he takes it away. He blesses with wealth and he impoverishes some. Right? He gives health or he gives sickness. He does as he pleases because he is God. He is not a really powerful human being or superhero. He is God, very God, and the entire universe exists for his purposes only. You don't tell him that God's hands are tied, that he can't help himself or he can't help you, that he would never let bad things happen to good people. That's just not true. And the testimony of Scripture repeats again and again that good people will suffer just as sinners will suffer. All people in this life will suffer. See, it is not okay what is happening to you. I mean, if you're going through a difficult time, if you're struggling with circumstances, if you're saying to yourself right now, man, I wish this was different, or I wish this person would love me, I wish these people would be my friend, or I wish I would get this respect from my coworker, or whatever it is, if you're looking for, man, I wish in this life, my circumstances and my relationships, I wish they were better, and it is suffering and it's pain for me, that is not okay, and I feel bad, and I know that that's a common reality. It's not okay to suffer. Suffering that is happening to you, but God has not lost control. That's what providence means. That's what sovereignty means. And instead of seeing suffering and difficulty as being that thing that is the foreign object that we must hate and detest and must flee from at all costs, by faith the Christian has to learn to find the grace in suffering. When I pray for a brother or sister in Christ, right? I'll go and see them. And I pray for them. Maybe they're going through some very painful circumstances. In particular, if they're going through like something that is related to sickness, cancer, or lupus, or so many things that afflict some of those that we love. As I pray for them, I realize that, that what I want to pray for them is that they find grace in their sufferings. That they recognize the hand of God in it. That regardless of the suffering, and as bad as it is, and it is not okay that you are suffering, I wish you weren't. But as you do, as we encounter this stuff, it reminds us that this world is broken. And that every time that we latch on to the things in this world and think, oh, I just need to be secure. I just need a little more security. I just need a little more love. I need just a little bit more affirmation. And then this world will be perfect. It's a lie. And sickness and disappointment is necessary for us and for our next generation. For the youth group kids, the kids in the nursery, the kids that are in children's church right now, they need a little bit of that pain. Why? Because it is God's grace to remind us this world is unworthy of you placing your hopes, your identity, your joys, and your security into this. It's not worthy of that. It cannot be worshipped. Security, peace, identity, joy, hope, these can only be found, fulfilled absolutely and perfectly in God through Christ Jesus. And if you're looking for that affirmation or for that hope or that joy, for that sense of good being, everything working out in a good life, in others, in circumstances, in people, you will be disappointed at some point. Naomi is the female version of Job. Have you realized that? She is an absolute... She's in every way a carbon copy of Job in losing so much and finding this bitter complaint, this temptation to fall into this bitterness, but still speaking foundationally from a place of faith and theology that is accurate. It is God's hand that has been bitter or that has been against her. And the thing, and understandably, she's saying, turn back and be safe. Find a safe world. A safe life, not this life. The result is a leaving and a cleaving. Right? Her first admonition was return home, be blessed. Second admonition was turn back and be safe. And the third, it's not so much the admonition, but now the response of the two young ladies. There's a leaving and there's a cleaving. Verse 14. Then they lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And Naomi said, see, your sister-in-law has come back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. This is the literary genius. If you haven't read Ruth in a while, I'll take some time once a week, maybe in your personal devotions or maybe in your family worship time. Just read a chapter. Right? This week, chapter next week, etc. It is worth your while. It is a brilliant piece of literature, not just of theology. It is wonderful because it is so connected to us in a very real way. These are real people. These aren't larger than life. These are people struggling. These are people hurting. And how they interact and the way that it's written is so wonderfully done. Remember earlier, it was Naomi that kisses them and then they all wail it out. They emotionally just let out their tears. But now, they wail together first, and then it's Orpah that reaches out and kisses her mother-in-law. It's a tender gesture of love at the moment of her departing. If you read just verse 14, all you would get from that is Orpah kisses mother-in-law. That's not weird. But as soon as we get to verse 15, we realize that everyone there knew what that meant. It was a farewell kiss, a sign of her affection for her mother-in-law, but that her mother-in-law's arguments had won her over. She's going back. So Naomi turns to Ruth and says, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Right? Return after your sister-in-law. There's a couple of things here that make me wonder. I mean, should Naomi be really encouraging Ruth to leave? Especially if she's going to say something like, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. And one thing we got to take into mind, right, is that this is just the bitter exasperation of a faltering faith. Naomi is having a hard time. Can you blame her? Right? And she sees it as, it is going to add to my sorrow to watch you slowly fade into old age, into further barrenness. And that when I die, I could give you nothing to bless you. Can you blame her? But at the same time, I want to make clear, she is not commending the return back to your gods. She's just assuming that sister-in-law, that Orpah, that since she has gone back to her people, she'll go back to her old gods. She's not necessarily commending that. She's not saying, Ruth, that's what you need to do. But she's giving Ruth an actual and real option. You don't have to follow me. With all of the things that are going on, I know who my God is. And that's why I go back to Bethlehem. So if I'm going to die, at least I die in the land of Elimelech. Even if I could give even if I can't give his name to a future progeny, at least I go back to that town. I go back to where we once were. I go back to home. But for Ruth, you don't owe me that. You don't owe any of that. Go back. You know? Find a better course. But Ruth, and here's the cleaving. Verse 14, the end of that, it says, but Ruth clung to her. See, the reason why I say this, the leaving and cleaving, is because I'm kind of tongue-in-cheek making a connection between that and Genesis 2:24. Because, you know, it happens to be the same exact word. Ruth clings to her. In the same way that Genesis 2:24 says, for this cause, a man will leave his father and mother, right? It's our marriage verse. And will do what? Will cleave, will cling to his wife. It's the same term. And it's almost to that affection and to that depth of loyalty. She is clinging to her, and Naomi understands what that means, right? Against all reasonable hope, Ruth will not be moved. Ruth will remain with her and will cling to her as if by a marriage vow. I mean, think about this. If you were Ruth's friend, or she is your cousin, or she's your sister, and she gives you her options. Well, I could go to Bethlehem with mother-in-law. Yeah, she doesn't have a husband. I don't have a husband. None of us have kids. I know I'm a Moabitess, so I'd be seen as a foreigner and an enemy to some, right? And as far as I know, there's no chance of getting married. I might never have any kids. I mean, I do have to take care of mother-in-law. She can't take care of herself. Or I could come back home, right? I could settle down, probably meet somebody, not too terrible a Moabite man, and live life as most people would want to live. What would you tell her? Right? I mean, you only have one life to live. What would you tell her? You'd be tempted at least to say, it's not unreasonable. It's not unreasonable what your mother-in-law is telling you. Orpah is not, you know, I'm not mad at her. In fact, let me say this about Orpah. I keep saying Oprah is a very nice lady, I'm sure. But this is about Orpah. Notice that the scriptures don't have a particular criticism of her. It could be that she has a wicked ambition that she is self-centered. She's only seeking her own interests. She has, you know, she says, you know what? You know, you're right. What am I doing? I love you guys, but I can't go down that path and I need to go back. And it's all self-serving. It could be. But that's not how the Scriptures or the Holy Spirit condemns her. Not at all. There is condemnation of other women for false motives or for incomplete motives, like in Luke 17 when Jesus says, remember Lot's wife. Right, 17:53. I remember that because there's actually there used to be a billboard along the, I think it's the 91. As you drive by, it says Luke 17:13. I would always see that. I go, what is that? What is that? And then later I look it up, and it's remember Lot's wife. And you're like, that's it. Like you know, no John 3:16 or something that's kind of a little more valuable to life and salvation. Just kind of remember Lot's wife. In other words, Lot's wife messed up. We do not hear nor do we see writings, right, even amongst as far as I know, amongst the Jewish teachers that criticize Orpah as if she was a wicked unbeliever. They just kind of leave it be. The argument for Orpah was for Orpah. I knew I was going to do that again. Was too strong. The prospects, there is no prospects going forward. Mother-in-law is right. I'll take her counsel. As one scholar put it, we can understand Orpah, but we must emulate Ruth, right? And here's the third point. Verse 16. Ruth chooses a faithful life. And I see, as we scroll through, you see how the different, you know, headings. I wanted you to see something, right? We just saw Naomi pleading for a safer life. But this is Ruth's reaction, starting in verse 16. Ruth chooses a faithful life. Right? Naomi's saying, hey, you should look for a safer life. Ruth is saying, no, I'd rather choose the faithful one. Ruth says, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. I want you to see the structure. Do you see the structure there? And you see all of those lines? I indented that on purpose. It forms kind of this poetic literary structure that the Hebrews often use to place some emphasis on things and to parallel an idea so that the idea is complete. And so you see the top line, right? One of the slides will have just the top line and the bottom line. They're parallel. Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. I'm going to go with you. My commitment is to you. And then see the bottom line, how it parallels the same sentiment? And may the Lord, may Yahweh, and she uses the same Lord, she uses the same personal name of God. She said, may Yahweh do to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. In other words, I am determined to not leave you. I will return. And I will follow you. Don't send me off because as I've made this commitment before the Lord, as a covenant promise, let the Lord do to me and worse than anything that I can imagine if I break my covenant promise to you. See, so they're parallel. So the next level in, right? Line 2 and line 4. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. See, this is you go there, I'm right with you. I'm right at your side. If you're gonna settle here, I'll settle here. And if you pick up and you move again, I'll pick up and move again with you. My commitment is wherever you go, wherever the destination is, I am with you. And you see that paralleled in line 4, where you die, and this goes even beyond that. See, as I go with you, where you go, as I lodge, where you lodge, when you die, I will remain and I will die. Because right, even in marriage covenant relationships, you realize the covenant is broken when one of us dies. And so as part of our marriage thing, till death do you part, if one of them dies, then the other is free. Right? From that covenant bond. But Ruth is saying there's more. When you die, I'm going to stay right there. I will die where you die. Probably about 20, 30 years later, but I will stay there and die. Where you died, and where you were buried, I will make sure I'm buried in the same family plot with you. See, the intensity of her commitment to her goes deeper and deeper. But at the center of it all, And this is the way that these chiastic structures are formulated. Your parallel structure, A and A prime, B and the B prime, and as you get to the middle, you get to the most significant point of it all. It's almost like you're zooming in on the middle ground that makes the parallel structure stand out. Your people will become my people. Your God will be my God. We are inserting in our English language the will. Right? It's literally in the Hebrew, your people, my people, your God, my God. It could be a declaration of promise, like from this day, Ruth followed the God of the Israelites. Or it could be a reaffirmation of something that she's learned from her husband already. Your people are my people, and your God is my God. Whatever it is at this particular junction in her life, it's a promise of faithfulness, not just to Naomi, but to the God that Naomi serves. And let me say this, right? This is the opposite, the reverse of a prosperity gospel. I mean, what has she heard from Naomi? Hey, you should follow this God because this God gives you blessings. He wants to see you happy in this life. He wants to see you fulfilled. And so if you're sick, you go to this God heals. If you're poor, don't worry. Have faith because this God rewards. He makes you rich. You're going to be wealthy. You're going to enjoy. You're going to delight in this life because that's the way that this God is. No, her testimony, Naomi's testimony is that the hand of my God, that the hand of Yahweh has been bitter against me. And here's Ruth. Well, count me in. That's what I'm talking about, right? This is a place of faith because everything that she has seen in the life of Naomi and her testimony about who God is, she recognizes immediately that God must be powerful. He is even there in the midst of our struggle and our suffering. That this is God's doing. And instead of being recoiled by that, she says, see, that's just how great God must be. And she is all in on a God that is a God that is powerful enough but allows difficulties and allows suffering and allows pain. Ruth's leap of faith outdoes even Abraham's. Because people often compare Ruth and Abraham. Because Abraham was similarly called out of family, out of country, right, to go to a different place. But Abraham received a promise before he left. I'm going to make you great amongst the entire world. Ruth had no prospects. She had no idea if she's ever going to get married or have kids, period. Abraham had a word from the Lord. I mean, the Lord literally spoke to Abraham and said that I am going to direct your way. I will bless you, and through you I'll bless the world. Ruth had the testimony of a bitter mother-in-law. Abraham had possessions, a wife, a supporting cast, a family. Ruth had no husband, no children, no wealth, no one else. Orpah just left, right? She just has a life of caring for an aging mother-in-law who has given up hope. She walks forward with no promise in hand, no divine blessing promise, no spouse or family guaranteed, no hope to be spoken of. And here she is saying, your people, my people, your God, my God. You got to be kidding me. See, at this point, if you're looking at this or you're reading this and you're thinking, you know, that's what I need. I need a Ruth in my life. Right? Someone who loves me like that. You got the whole thing twisted. Right? Oprah. Orpah. Oh, man. Orpah, I understand. There's a go in peace and be blessed. Naomi, I feel her pain. I get that she is struggling with bitterness in life. But Ruth, little sister, are you out of your mind? See, you don't need a Ruth in your life to feed you that kind of loving support. You need to become a Ruth in the life of others. As long as you are clinging to what you need from other people, what you need from circumstances, you can never walk out in faith, in hope, in the providence of God like Ruth does. Right? That's literally impossible. You need to live for something greater than yourself. If you feel detached or you're not getting what you want from those people, from this church, from that job, right? From this circumstance. If you're unsettled in your prospects for what you feel like is the necessary good life for your happiness, then realize something that Scripture reveals to us again and again and again. Circumstances and people cannot give you what only God can give you in Christ Jesus. You need identity, community, joy, hope, security. If you find that in God, we don't wish the bad circumstances upon you, but if you find those things in God, it doesn't matter what circumstances are upon you. And it doesn't matter how people treat you or don't treat you. You'll be okay. Because you're actually secure in the thing that is absolutely secured. Let me give you the last part. We run over time. So the two of them went on until, this is the bitter homecoming. And if you see bitter homecoming, because that connects with our tragic sojourning. They left from Bethlehem to Moab. Now from Moab back to Bethlehem. This is the bitter homecoming, 19 to 22. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. It is an excellent word. It means that they're just, like, it is often used of jubilation and party. Like, people are like, hey, dude, did you hear Naomi's in town? Naomi's in town? What are you talking about? Elimelech's Naomi? Let's go. And so all the women are kind of, you know, it must have been a fairly small town. They all knew them. It had been probably at this point at least 10 years, maybe significantly longer, maybe 12, 13 years. But nevertheless, the women said, is this Naomi? And remember the name. Is this lovely? And she says to them, verse 20, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Mara means bitterness. And she says, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Again, this is her expressing to the best of her ability how she interprets God's hand upon her. See, her theology is mostly right. God is involved in everything that has happened in her life, but it is incomplete. Is that all that God was doing? She says, call me bitter, don't call me lovely. Verse 21, she says, I went away full. The Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? And the thing I want you to take away from that is she says she went away full. What an interesting reinterpretation of the circumstances of her life then. We had a famine, but she says, I look back on that time of famine, I was full. See, at a time when she thought, we don't have any food, let's move to Moab, let's get out of here. Right? Let's look after our own. She looks back and says, I'd rather have my own. I would rather have had my husband and my sons here and we almost starve in Bethlehem. I was full then, even in famine. And then when I went and we found food, when I come back empty. Not because you guys have food now, but it's not food that I really long for. It's not material circumstances that really are the blessing. It's the relationships. And now they are gone from my hand. Right? She went away full. She came back empty. And then this last statement, verse 22, is the summary of chapter 1. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. I told you that the author is a genius. That last phrase is interesting, right? When did they return? At the beginning of the barley harvest. Almost to say, wait a minute. There might be a sliver of hope in all of this. And we come full circle. If you zoom in on Naomi, she says, I went from fullness in the midst of famine to barrenness. I come back empty. But if you zoom out on the nation, they went from a time of famine where they did not have food, literally, to this time of barley harvest. Here's a few things about God's providence. One, it's pervasive. Good and bad, Israel or Moab, among the great or among the lowly, right? In the White House or in your house, right? Around the world, in another nation, or in your backyard. God's providence is in everything. God's providence, secondly, is mysterious. Right? How does the doubly tragic loss of husband and sons lead to the kingly blessing and hope of all of Israel and the hope of the world in terms of salvation? Well, we could ask that about so many things. How does the hatred of older brothers lead one to become the second in command of Egypt to preserve the people of God in their time of difficulty? How do young boys who are cast out into the Babylonian exile affect the world power and preserves God's people and their promise for Israel? How does this, God's providence is mysterious and God's providence is faithful? Again, we can think about the nearness of God when things are going well, but He is near even when things are not. Let me close with this one final thought. It's tempting for us to look at the end game and say that God fixes everything. And say, you know what the lesson in the book of Ruth is? Is that no matter how bad things get, God's going to double your good stuff. He's going to double your pleasure like double mint gum, right? It's going to get better and better, right? We can look at the book of Job and say the same thing. At the end of Job's life, he got a double portion of everything. So it all worked out in terms of the math, it worked out better. Does that work for you? That if a hit and run driver kills one of your kids, at least you had two more? Does that work for you? That doesn't work. That is not the point of those books. The point is to highlight the real danger of the temptation to lose hope because this world is messed up. Ruth did not know she was going to get married at this point. She did not know she was going to have kids. And she certainly didn't know that her great-grandson was going to be David and that to David would be a promise of a Messiah who would come and he would rescue the world of its sins in Jesus Christ. She didn't know any of those things. The lesson in Ruth and Job is that sometimes it's so hard to hang on, but you hang on. Why? Because God is real. And sometimes that's all you're doing is barely hanging on. And that's where we all come in for one another, to help each other hang on when it's hard to hang on. The book of Ruth is one filled with sweet and bitter providence. Oh, man, it's a worthwhile book for you. Take some time to read it as we study through it together for the rest of this year. Stand together as I close this in a word of prayer.